Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I think there are two big questions that most people have, compared to which everything else is really just details. Those questions are we alone in the universe, or is there intelligent life elsewhere? And secondly, is there life after death? And I think that whether they admit it or not, every thinking person is curious about these things. Why else would there be so many TV shows and movies about UFOs and aliens? And of course, a fundamental premise of all religions is that there is life after death, and how you behave in this life affects what happens to you in the next. So these are big questions. But what's ironic is that science, which seeks answers to all of nature's unknowns, generally avoids these two big topics like the plague. Scientists who look into the functioning of the brain and consciousness upon death, and especially when people are revived from being brain dead, have to be very careful how they approach it to avoid being shunned professionally. And although NASA has a small program on what's called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, using radio telescopes and other sensors, they're careful not to touch any suggestion that ETs visit us on Earth. Government in general won't touch it. And as a result, the news media treat these topics with a kind of nervous, titillated laughter. And the reality is there are a lot of loonies who hunt for ghosts or who think that everything unusual that's seen in the sky automatically has to be a flying saucer. And so sensible people don't want to be lumped in with them. So that's why it's refreshing to encounter a journalist who takes a very level-headed, objective, investigative, scientific-style approach to either of these profoundly important topics. My guest today is one such person. Her name is Leslie Kane, and she's written a book called Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife. And it covers evidence for life after death from several different perspectives and is full of fascinating stories. So for that reason, and because the topic is so important, I'm going to do two separate shows on this. Welcome, Leslie.
Hi, Court. It's so great to be with you. Thanks for that introduction.
Yeah, well, thanks for being on with us. We're looking forward to the shows here. And I'll just give a little preview first. Your book has four parts. Okay, so part one deals with children who seem to remember the lives of people who've died as if they were their own past lives. Part two goes to the other end and deals with people who die and are brought back to life by extreme medical intervention and what they experience during that transitional interlude, let's call it. So those are the topics we'll get into in this first show. But then part three of your book describes modern-day mediums, who are people who connect with the spirits of the dead. And part four describes something I'd actually never heard of, which is materializations of the spirits of dead people in a physical form, and not exactly ghosts, but something like it. So that's for next week's show, those two parts. All right, so let's plunge in, Leslie. Just briefly, how did you get involved in this investigation of the afterlife?
Well, I've just been interested in the topic for a long time, and I've been interested in both the questions that you raised at the beginning of the show, and I've just looked into it over the years, off and on, and then about 4 years ago, I was invited to write a book on it. I was just so happy about it because it gave me the opportunity to focus full time on the topic, whereas before I had just sort of dabbled in it off and on. It was an incredible experience to not only do the research, but also to end up having personal experiences that I never expected to have, which make the book, I think, a lot more interesting. And, you know, when you can bring in your own personal experiences into something, it changes it a lot. Yeah, it's just I've just always been interested in the sort of bigger questions that we face. And I'm happy that I could apply journalism to this kind of question, which is not usually what journalists do. But that's how I've taken my journalism. I've applied it to questions like this and really gone deeply into them, not just done, you know, little stories here and there the way most journalists do. So, yeah. So to say how I got involved, it's really just my personal interest in these bigger questions.
Well, it's a mainstream publisher, Crown Archetype Books, who published the book, and I've got the hardcover copy. It's a beautifully produced book. I'm impressed that they reached out to you and asked you to do the book, and that is lucky. A lot of people write books and spend years trying to sell that book.
Yeah, so well, it's because I had published with them before, so they were familiar with me and the kind of work I did. This is a topic of great interest right now, I think, to people, so. And I do have a unique approach to it, I think, so that, it makes for an interesting read, I think, an interesting journey for me anyway.
Tell us about some of the children who remember past lives, which is in part one of the book.
Well, I mean, this to me, I started the book with these cases because they're so compelling and so readable and kind of exciting to read. And there are many cases that which involve very, very young children. We're talking maybe 2 years old, 3 years old, that just start describing very specific details of what they say is their life before this one. For the best cases, the memories are very specific. Sometimes the children display behavior that relates to the past life, such as phobias about something, that the way they died, or dressing up as a member of the opposite sex, or playing games that involve the professions they had before, all kinds of things like that. They long for the previous family, or they might feel vengeful towards somebody who was bad to them in the previous life, or they'll fantasize all of that. So there's a lot of behavioral stuff that goes along with it, as well as memories. They'll often have nightmares about how they died. And another interesting component is sometimes there are birthmarks or birth defects on the child, which correspond to physical wounds that occurred on the previous person that they say they were. And so the cases that are relevant, of course, are the ones in which investigators are able to find who the previous person that the child claims they were, to find records of that person, to find the family of that person, and to verify that indeed those memories are accurate. The cases where we can't verify them are not really important, but there are over 2,000 cases at the University of Virginia, which is a center. They have a center at the University of Virginia called the Division of Perceptual Studies, and they've been studying for many decades. They've been studying cases of children with these memories, and they have 1,400 cases on record of cases that were actually solved, which means that the child has provided enough information for them to locate the previous person. So it's a very, very fascinating area of investigation, and it's very hard to explain how the child could have these memories other than them being some kind of a reincarnation situation. It's hard to come up with any other explanations.
You mentioned that these memories and their expression of them start off when they're very young. I mean, how young? I mean, basically at the time they can first talk or at some
exactly.
age?
Exactly. Yeah, often. And that's why they're so kind of genuine, because there's no way these young children, just learning to talk, have been exposed to anything that would bring these memories forward in their minds. The parents can verify that, or people around them can verify. So that's one of the things that's so compelling about them. These children are really young.
Do they go back and forth between being, as they get a little older, let's say into toddlers, where they can, you know, communicate more like children, do they go back and forth between being, you know, little Jimmy and being the previous life person? Or do they just really embody that previous life person and that's the persona they project all the time?
I think it's more that they're clear that the memories of that person are memories. Mm. I mean, they don't believe that they are the person who they remember being in the previous life. I mean, some of the more extreme cases, they may have trouble differentiating themselves, but in most cases, they're aware that they're talking about somebody different who they were before, as opposed to somebody they were now. But they will play act a lot of things from that life. In most cases, the children are just normal kids, you know, and the memories will come through them at certain moments, and they just live their normal lives as in the present. But they keep remembering things. Things keep coming out, and their behaviors and their nightmares and so on are greatly impacted by it. But I think they usually know that who they are now as opposed to who they were then.
Okay, so it's not a case of talking in a different voice and being almost like they're possessed. They remember something as if it happened to them, but they know it's previous to their life. So.
Right, exactly. And if it was okay. Something like you're talking, you know, possession, or I think that would be an area for a psychoanalyst or psychiatrist,
yeah,
or something, you know, if they were really multiple personalities or something like that.
Right.
No, it's very different than that. And what's crucial about it is that for the case to be solved, of course, the information has to be very specific and traceable. And that's what's so extraordinary about it. I mean, they'll remember names and places and, you know, all these details about their previous family and where they lived and how they died before and locations and very specific information. And that's what's so extraordinary about them.
So in your book, you make it clear that this happens all around the world, and in fact, more commonly in Asian countries for reasons that you kind of speculate on than it does in this country. But, you know, partly this, I think, must freak out the parents to a considerable extent, right?
Especially in America. I mean, in Asian countries, I think one of the reasons it doesn't necessarily happen more there, but we hear about it more because these countries have religions that accept reincarnation. I mean, Buddhism and Hinduism and so on. And because a lot of investigators have gone over to those countries and documented the cases, because the families there are willing to talk about them. It's not considered something weird, mm-hmm, like it is here. So here we don't hear about the cases as much, but chances are they occur. And that, you know, if a child just starts talking like this and the parents just say, oh, it's just a dream, you know, go, you know, don't bother me with it or whatever, it just goes away. Or the child might talk about it for a year, but nothing ever happens. The parents don't even recognize what it is. So, you know, if you don't have an environment in which the families are encouraged to recognize this and in which the society accepts it, you're going to have a lot fewer cases. But the irony is that some of the best cases we have on record involve there's two specific ones that I write about in my book, which involve two American boys, and they're fairly recent cases. So the cases we do have here are very, very good. We just don't have as many of them.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, the two boys that you mentioned just now, James and Ryan, you deal with at length, partly because their parents were very willing to believe once this began to be a persistent phenomenon in their child's kind of presentation, then they began to investigate themselves what was going on. And so you had a lot more ability to interact with them, and they were more interactive about it. But James and Ryan, so it just very quickly, Leslie, why don't you just kind of give us a thumbnail idea of the story of James?
I'll try to make it thumbnail, because there's a lot of information that's involved, but it's the opening chapter of the book. So basically he was only not even two when he began talking about experiences or referencing things from this previous life. And he became obsessed with airplanes, World War II airplanes. I mean, his initial experience involved his dad taking him to a flight museum where he looked at all these airplanes when he was like this little guy in diapers, and he was absolutely mesmerized by these World War II airplanes. He would not leave them. He had incredibly strong reactions to them. He told his mom when she handed him a little toy airplane with a lump under it, she said, look, it's got a gas tank under it. And he said, no, Mom, that's a drop tank. And this was like not even 2 year old, and his parents could not figure out how he knew what a drop tank was, because it is something. It's a tank you use to store extra fuel. His mom had told him it was a bomb.
That's right.
What it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he corrected her. So, they didn't know what to make of it. And then eventually he started to have these horrific nightmares, this little guy, in his crib, you know, just absolute horrific screaming during the night. He would be curled up in his little fetal position. His parents were really freaked out about it. And then over time, he started to put words to his nightmares. This was like almost every night. They said 5 nights out of the week, probably. And he started to wake up screaming and say, airplane crash on fire. Little man can't get out. And this is what he would say during his nightmares. Airplane crash on fire. Little man can't get out. And he was sort of reliving this, it appeared to them. So over a period of time, he managed to communicate to his parents a lot of specific information, such as that he was shot down by the Japanese. When they said, who was the little man? He said, it was me. He said the little man's name was James, but they thought, of course, he was just referring to himself. But he said he flew a plane called a Corsair. He flew off a boat named the Natoma. He had a close friend who was a pilot named Jack Larson. So you can see how specific those facts are. Hmm. He talked about being shot in the front of the plane, you know, exactly where it was shot, and that he was near the island of Iwo Jima when it happened. Also, there was a period of time when he drew intense, you know, these very dense drawings of a plane going down, a plane crashing. And when he would sign them James 3, these drawings, he was just obsessed with them. His parents would say, why did you sign it James 3? And he would say, because I'm the third James. Of course, that made no sense to them. But anyway, to make a long story short, his dad, who was very determined to prove that his child was not remembering a past life. I mean, you mentioned earlier that, yeah, the parents were supportive. But in this case, his mom was more willing to accept it than his dad. His dad just could not accept that this could be a past life memory. But he did all the research on everything that James would say, trying to prove him wrong. Eventually, he found the casualty list from the Natoma Bay, which was an actual aircraft carrier in World War II that some planes flew off of in World War II. And there was a battle near Iwo Jima, and there was only one casualty on that plane. He found all this information out after going to veterans meetings and doing a lot of research trying to track all this information down. And it turned out that, and he also... Anyway, I just can't take the time to give you a lot of details, but it turned out there was only one casualty off the Natoma Bay, And it was a young pilot by the name of James Houston Jr. And of course, when his dad found that information out, he almost fainted because James had always said, "I'm the third James," right? And the junior after this name meant that he was the third James, if indeed he was the next one. And so he was able to find Jack Larson, the friend that James had mentioned who was still alive, and was able to verify that all the information that James had provided corresponded to the life of this man who was killed in 1945, James Houston Jr. They met the sister, too. James Houston Jr.'s sister was now 84. Hmm. Her name was Anne Barron. And they met her, and she was absolutely convinced that little James was her brother reincarnated because he told her all this information about their childhoods, information that he couldn't possibly have known, that only she knew. And so it's a long, long story about how, there's much more that James remembered. You know, there's a lot more details. But basically, it was very clear that he was remembering the life of this person. And he was also obsessed with airplanes throughout his childhood. He would play with nothing else. And he also knew information about different types of airplanes that he couldn't possibly have known. He was never exposed to it. So anyway, there's more to the story, but that's it in a nutshell, that basically when you can corroborate and find the person that the child remembers as being absolutely where everything matches, that's very compelling, very compelling. And James is a completely normal kid. I met him when he was 18 years old, and he excelled all through high school. And the other thing that happens, Court, is that usually these children forget their memories starting around age 5 or 6. They just fade away, and the child just becomes much more rooted in the present. And that's what happened with James. I mean, he's not at all concerned about these things now as a grown kid, but he had a completely normal childhood and excelled in every way in high school. That's the story of James Houston. James Houston Jr., now James Leininger.
Fascinating story, and that was a big thumbnail. And we've got a whole other part to come to here for the rest of the show. But a couple of questions, though. Do these things ever occur where an adult begins to remember it, or is it always that in early childhood they remember it, just briefly?
No, I mean, there are cases of adult with memories, and a lot of them take place under hypnosis. So I feel that, and some of those cases are interesting, but I feel that the children, they're much more evidential for so many reasons than, you know, because they haven't been influenced by anything. You can't explain where they got the information. If an adult is under hypnosis, it just makes it a lot more complicated in terms of being really, really evidential. As far as I'm concerned, and since I only had limited space in the book, you know, I'm covering so many areas of research, I focused on the child cases because I think they're the strongest of all the cases. But that doesn't mean there aren't some interesting cases of adults with memories. There absolutely are. And adults that feel they've verified their memories as well. But I don't know if they have as much detail to them as these. And if they do involve hypnosis, some people might not think hypnosis is reliable, or that maybe the adults got the information somewhere else, you know. But right. With a child, you can never make a claim like that.
Right. Well, you make a point in your book, you know, convincingly and at some length, that it's more persuasive if a child who can barely speak has a lot of detailed, specific information that he would have had or she would have had no access to, no possible way to ever encounter. And then later on, if somebody takes notes, as in both the cases you talk about of American kids, if later on those details can be verified one by one right down the line, that makes it a pretty conclusive kind of a thing. So, you know,
And it's very important that you mentioned about them being written down. One of the very important elements of any case that's going to be considered really convincing is that there needs to have been a record made of everything the child says prior to them finding what we call the previous personality. And in both the cases in my book, and we'll just focus on James now, fortunately, there was a lot of stuff that his dad printed out on the internet, which shows dates of when he was actually researching things. And there was a TV crew that came in and did a whole show with James before they had any idea who the previous personality was. So everything is on record that he said. And therefore, you can't argue that, well, his parents adjusted it later when they found out who the person was. It's very important that that record be made.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, the premise is that the child is born with that person's, that previous now dead person's spirit in them sometime in the womb maybe or so. And And, you know, whenever a spirit moves into a fetus, that person that moved in there, let's call it, to put it in simple terms. But I wonder whether it's possible that the children aren't really reincarnations of that person, but that instead maybe the spirit of the dead person has kind of moved in and taken over the child's body at some point after their birth. I mean, that would be totally speculative, obviously, but, you know, had you...
Yeah, thought? I mean, I don't think we know anything about the mechanism by which this happens, or,
sure.
You know, it could, I mean... We don't know anything except that the child has the memories and they can be verified, and that he sort of seems to be reliving it. It's very internal and very real for him. But other than that, yeah, I mean, who knows how the whole process works and what it really means. As far as the child is concerned, they were that person. They have absolutely no doubt about it. And they're the only source we have for the information.
All right, so before we turn to the next part of this particular show... Have you noticed any certain characteristics, or have researchers who deal with a lot of the, you know, the 1,400 or so cases that you said have been proven so far around the world, are there certain characteristics that these children share? Is there any kind of noticeable link among them, or is it just a totally random spectrum of kids?
It's pretty random. I mean, you know, they're not disturbed kids by any means, but they're usually certain similar things, like the ages in which these things happen. The age in which the memories tend to go away. But I would say, you know, I don't think you can draw a lot of, like, say, oh, they're all certain types of kids, or they're this or that. There's no kind of uniformity to it. It can be any kids from all walks of life, you know, all races, all religions. One interesting thing, though, that I might throw in here is that, well, the majority of them, not, you know, about two-thirds of the cases, the previous personality's death was a violent one, was a sudden kind of unnatural death, you know, an accident, or James, for instance, being shot down in an airplane, something that's kind of sudden and traumatic. It's kind of interesting that most of the cases involve that kind of a death, and the hypothesis might be that there's something sort of unfinished about that for them. They were suddenly cut off in their lives before... was natural for them to die, and so there's something that sort of needs to still be worked through for them, and that's maybe why, if you're going to accept the theory of reincarnation, that's maybe why they haven't been able to, they need to come back, you know. But anyway, that's just an interesting point, that so many of these deaths are violent and unnatural, the ones that the kids remember.
Yeah, and in some of the cases, the kids only remember that death period just before the death of the previous person, but in other cases, they remember much of that person's life. But anyway, we need to switch gears. You are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with journalist and author Leslie Kane, who's written a book called Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife. And it's going to be a two-part show. This is the first of the two episodes of the show. And we're going to turn to next to part two of the book, which is a phenomenon that's often termed near-death experience, or NDE. So just quickly, Leslie, we only have a few minutes left now, but give me maybe one example, as briefly as you can, out of that section of the book, of a good case of an NDE.
Okay, or, you know, what I actually might be more useful to talk about, Court, would be an actual out-of-body experience that's evidential, because I think a lot of people know about NDEs, that the person will leave their body and they'll go on a journey into another dimension, and they'll describe the light and the tunnel and everything. But, you know, as a journalist, I feel almost that what we're dealing with here is the question of consciousness and whether consciousness can function independently of the body, which is such a critical question. And there are cases in which people, you know, when they're completely dead, essentially clinically dead, and then when they're revived, they will talk about things that they saw and heard when they left their bodies during that period of death, which can actually be verified by people who were there. So that's proof that if you're going to accept that they were out of their bodies, basically, and that they were experiencing things when they had no brain function.
Mm-hmm.
And a quick case, I mean, I know we don't have a lot of time, but one example of that was the case of the shoe on the ledge, which I've written about in my book, where a woman who was under cardiac arrest in a hospital in Seattle was completely gone, and they frantically brought her back. And when she came back, she said that she had left her body and she'd seen a tennis shoe sitting outside the window of this huge hospital. It was sitting outside the window on the ledge at the window. And there was this tennis shoe there, and she described what it looked like, what color it was, where the shoelaces were, certain things that she saw. And she asked the social worker to go find it. Of course, the social worker thought it was ridiculous, but the woman was so agitated about it that she agreed to do it. And to make a long story short, she went, you know, looked for a long time, and she eventually looked out the window and saw this tennis shoe sitting there, and it was exactly as the patient had described it. And there were certain markings on that shoe that weren't visible from inside the window, were only visible from outside the window, from the perspective of being outside that window looking in. So that was also an interesting opponent. So something like that would highly suggest that this woman's consciousness somehow was able to function while she had no brain activity. She was essentially clinically dead. And so that's very evidential of the fact, not that we survived death, but the fact that consciousness can function without a brain. And that's sort of a precursor. If we're going to explore the question of whether we can survive death, if we can establish the fact that consciousness can function independently of a brain, that's an important component that might lead us to therefore being able to go further with that. But that being able to establish that is really critical. And I think that's the key element of all the cases we have on of veridical OBEs like the one I just described, and cases of near-death experiences where people are having extraordinary experiences both in the vicinity of their dead bodies, their temporarily dead bodies, and in another realm, all of which indicates that consciousness is completely independent of the brain. That's what it appears to suggest.
Yeah, and there are other interesting examples in Leslie's book, like the one she just described, but we're going to have to kind of cut short, and you're going to have to go get the book and read about them. So, Leslie, I do want to ask you, though, your interactions with the people in your book seem to have convinced you, and in reading your book, you know, it's pretty convincing to anyone who reads it, I think, that there is life after death. Did you absolutely believe that going in, or did you find that you had some changes and shifts in your own philosophy, in your own point of view about that?
Oh, I had major shifts, Court. Absolutely. I mean, I went in, you know, I was intrigued by it because of things I'd read over the years and people I had talked to and so on. I was definitely intrigued by it, but I had absolutely no, I was not convinced. I mean, I was sort of an open-minded skeptic, you know, very open-minded skeptic. And that's what was so extraordinary, because I think this book was really a journey for me. I was doing a lot of research, but in conjunction with that, I was having my own experiences, which we can talk about next time. And also, I was learning as I went along, and I was becoming more and more convinced myself as I was researching and writing the book. So it's sort of an organic process for me, and I definitely, from the beginning to the end, I definitely was in a very different place when I started the book from where I ended up.
The book is Surviving Death by Leslie Kane. Her last name is spelled K-E-A-N, Leslie Kane. You can get it on Amazon or at most booksellers. And you can find her on Facebook at Leslie Kane, L-E-S-L-I-E-K-E-A-N. And the book also has its own website at survivingdeathkane.com, survivingdeathkane.com. Leslie, it's been fascinating. And again, this is part one of a two-part series on this topic. So anybody who's been interested in this one would like to tune in again next week, I think. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.